The following podcast is part of the MindBodySpirit.fm podcast network.
Support for this show comes from the world-famous annual International Yoga Festival in Rishikesh, India. Deepen your practice, explore your soul, and expand your consciousness in the lap of the Himalayas, the birthplace of yoga, with yogis from around the world. Learn more at internationalyogafestival.org.
From Spirituality and Health magazine, this is Essential Conversations. Our guest today is Matthew Ricard, a molecular biologist, Buddhist monk, photographer, author, humanitarian, and the French translator for His Holiness the Dalai Lama. We last spoke with him in July of 2015 when we focused on his book, Altruism, The Power of Compassion to Change Yourself and the World. We're delighted to have him back on Essential Conversations to discuss his newest book, A Plea for the Animals, The Moral, Philosophical, and Evolutionary Imperative to Treat All Beings with Compassion. An excerpt from the book appears in the November-December issue of Spirituality and Health magazine. Matthew Ricard, welcome to Essential Conversations.
Thank you so much. Yes, I'm glad we can connect again.
Yeah, me too. It was a delight talking to you before, and I'm looking forward to this, albeit too short, conversation right now. In the introduction to A Plea for the Animals, you write this, that this book is a logical and necessary follow-up to your previous book on altruism. I get the logic connection, but I'm curious about the notion that it's a necessary follow-up. What do you see as making this book necessary after the last one?
Well, you see, if we speak of a good heart, or altruism, compassion, benevolence, kindness, name it, you know, it is a more of an attitude towards others, towards sentient beings, to anyone who can make the difference between happiness and suffering, rather than a commodity that you have in a limited amount, and then you have to be very careful to whom you give it or not. So in that sense, since it is a qualitative attitude, like, you know, is the sun shining just on a few spots on Earth, or is it shining on the whole Earth? So in the sense, I think compassion should know no barriers. And one of the reasons is not just it's better if it doesn't, I would even argue, especially for those people who say that by turning your attention to other species, you may risk loving or taking care less of human beings. I would say that if you actually fragment and bias and narrow down your compassion, you would also have a lesser quality of compassion to your fellow human beings. So that's one of the arguments why it is necessary to have a full bloom, full-fledged compassion. It is necessary to include, 8 other million species who are our co-citizens on this earth, are sentient beings, they don't want to suffer. So if we exclude them, there is a gap, there's a kind of ethical incoherence in our very advanced civilization.
You know, you mentioned a couple of times just now the notion of a sentient being. And I remember, I don't know if this is true in the Tibetan tradition, but certainly every day in the Zen tradition, we would chant the Bodhisattva vows. And the first one was, sentient beings are innumerable. I vow to save them all. In the book, you make a distinction between this notion of sentience, which is common to Eastern religions. You mention Hinduism and Buddhism and Jainism. And the notion of soul that you think is, and I would agree, this is the focus of Western religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. First off, let's just be clear on the difference. How do you understand the difference between soul and sentience? And then we can get into why the difference leads to different approaches to treating animals.
Well, you know, I'm not a theologian, especially I've not studied well enough, you know, the religion of the book. Well, I think the notion of sentience is not a really philosophical one. No, like the soul could be, or like the Atman in Hindu religion, where you consider it as an individual entity that travels along. In Buddhism and Jainism, I guess, we have more a way of seeing there's a continuum of consciousness without, say, it's like a river without a boat traveling on it. So the continuity of consciousness makes a stream. Now, sentience is a very basic awareness of something that is able to know, even in a very rudimentary form. It doesn't need to have a self-reflective consciousness or intellect, the notion of I and so forth. The basic knowledge that in reaction to the outer world makes you somehow go towards what will favor your well-being and survival and move away or try to avoid what threatens your physical and mental integrity for those who have, you know, more advanced intellect and have emotions and so forth. So in that sense, sentience could be very simple. It doesn't require some intellectual faculties.
Which makes concern for animals far, or concern, when we have a concern for sentient beings, it broadens it to almost everything that exists.
Well, yes, it is a bit difficult to draw the exact border when you start, you know, the border areas are always difficult no matter what, in whichever field you go. So where to draw the line, you know, scientists will tell you more. If you have a nervous system, you start making a difference between what we will later, in a more sophisticated way, call pleasure and pain, or happiness and suffering. But still, you know, there's a continuum. It's a matter of degree. But fundamentally, when there is a kind of a difference with plants, which only react mechanically to outer stimuli, they don't seem to be able to delay a decision or to, you know, all kinds of things that comes with sentience. Anyway, this is a difficult concept, but I think the real debate, let's make it very simple. Any being that experience suffering, even in a very rudimentary form, somehow would rather not suffer. And that, in a way, at aspiration, which is very, very basic, we should have some concern and consideration for it. So that's the very simplest baseline.
And a very clear one, I think. And you juxtapose that in the book with, and I'm just going to give one example from, I can give a couple of examples actually here. One from St. Thomas Aquinas, who says that the love of one's neighbor does not include animals. And then centuries later, Descartes, and I'm not going to read the entire quote you have in the book, but he says, animals are no more than simple machines, automata. They feel neither pleasure nor pain nor anything else at all. And that kind of attitude, this notion that animals, when sentience is the principle, then we are on an equal footing with animals. I mean, there may be variations in the amount of self-consciousness and self-awareness, but sentience is shared by all. Whereas in the West, it seems like humans simply discounted the sentience of animals, or even if they did think they were sentient, they discounted the value of that sentience. So do you see it, this plea for the animals, a more difficult, do you see the case for this animal care more difficult in the West than you do in the East?
Oh, definitely, yes. And also, you know, the Descartes position, for instance, has made so that until 2 years ago in France, you know, domestic animals were considered as in the same category of furnitures, object that you own. It's actually exactly the word furniture that was used. So a sheep or a dog will be a walking table, of course. It flies to common sense. So I think the reason for that is quite simple. You know, when we were hunter-gatherers, animals were considered as different, not necessarily inferior, because, you know, when you have to deal especially with prey animal, you better run for your life. And they knew their habits, their customs. There was the spirit of the jaguar, the spirit of the elk. But then when we started to become sedentary and raise livestock with agriculture, and of course, we have to become familiar with those animals. They become almost part of the family. But at the end, we have to kill them. So it's a very, you know, uneasy situation. We feel we are a good person, and yet you have to kill an animal that you have been, you know, together for a long time. So you have to find kinds of justification. They don't have any soul. They don't feel anything. They're just like machines. Pain doesn't mean anything, etc. So I think it's a way, there's a cognitive dissonance there. But now, you know, science tells us that more and more, simple animals do have nervous termination to feel pain. For a long time, they thought that fish won't feel pain. Now we know they feel pain. We know that lobsters feel pain. We know that shrimps feel pain. So now, you know, the boundary is becoming thinner and thinner. And yet our ethics has not included that. And just to give you a staggering example, you know, we kill basically every hour 120 million animals every hour for our use. And that's in a week, more than any casualty in war for whole history of human beings. Okay, of course, we are not saying that they are the same, but you know, it goes every week practically unnoticed. So when you say that that in the East we would put on the same footing human beings and animals, certainly not if we had to choose between saving the life of a human being and a dog or whatever, because that argument has been used, you know, those animal rights protectors, they think that the life of a rat is just the same value as human being. Of course, nobody ever said that. But the fact that still, you know, it's not the same value as human beings, okay, fine, of course, obviously, but that doesn't mean they have a zero value. So basically, we are everything, they are nothing. That means, rightly so, the value of human beings, of human life, is no more negotiable. We don't have slaves anymore that we sell at certain price. So it's infinite, which is has to be like that. But when it comes to other species, it is zero unless it has a commercial or other kind of value.
Right, exactly. I mean, we actually do continue to have slavery. We do put a price on people.
But
so we still
do that.
This
is illegal.
right. At least it's that. Not too long ago, maybe a couple of years ago, Pope Francis got into a little bit of trouble when he was talking to this little boy whose dog had died, and the boy was very upset. And the Pope tried to comfort him by saying, well, don't worry, you'll meet your dog again in heaven. And that sent shockwaves out through the Catholic theological world because it implied that the dog had soul. And I think the soul issue, you know, whether or not you consider yourself a theologian, I think the soul issue in the West is really important, because if we imagine animals have souls, then they have certain rights. And we don't like in the West to think of animals having rights. We're having trouble even imagining that humans have rights. So,
yes.
You know, that I think the difference, while I understand that sanctions is not meant to equate humans and rats, still, I think the notion of sanctions as the bottom line is much more powerful than one that is not testable, like whether animals have souls or not. But I want to ask you something, and this is,
if I may say about Pope Francis, I mean, his encyclical is really remarkable about animals. He said that the wholesale industrialized slaughter that taking place is degrading basically human dignity, which is probably one of the strongest statements made by very high sort of like a pope or anyone like that. That's pretty clear.
Very, very clear. Very clear. You know, I wanted to ask you something more. Well, I don't know if it's personal or not. I don't mean it personal to you, but this is something that happened to me just in the last 2 months. I was spending time at a Tibetan Buddhist community in California called Ratna Ling. And I was in the library browsing through some books, and I came across this teaching called, well, in English, I can't even pronounce it in Tibetan, but in English, they translate it as ransom and release. And you mention it very, very briefly in the book, but the idea, if I understand it right, and I just like to get your take on this, and I ended up buying the liturgy for it, but the English translation of the liturgy for it from the Tibetan. And it seems like there's a practice of bringing animals into, or allowing animals to take refuge in the three jewels of Buddhism, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, the, the Buddha, the teachings, and the community. So, and then releasing them so that they can't be killed, they can't be abused, they can't be mistreated in any way. And then expecting that in a future incarnation, they will come back perhaps as humans. Does this have any influence on your practice, or was this any, did this have any influence on the book?
Yes. No, no, I've been, no, once a French critics who didn't read the book wrote, oh, this is an apology of Buddhism and stuff like that. Actually, we do a lot of animal freeing animals, a little bit more simple than what you mentioned. Of course, animals can't take refuge. They can't speak. They cannot have this notion. So basically what happens is to save them from death. And actually, if you see the dedication of this book, it's to one of my teacher, a Tibetan Lama, who's now has freed, I put 1 million, but now is about 30 million since then. Like fishes and all kinds of animals that are put back in the sea and so forth. So the idea is basically to give them a new lease of life instead of ending up in our stomachs. Now, while they do so, they do recite some prayers, the names of the Buddhas and so forth, wishing that in a future life, you know, they may have a life that gives them more opportunity to think about the spiritual path, disentangle themselves from the cause of suffering and ignorance, which is, of course, something that human beings have a special capacity for it. That doesn't give them a superiority, that gives them the right to oppress other species. But clearly, in terms of spiritual liberation, we have a capacity to achieve that that is far greater than other animals. That's why we make that wish. But the main point there is to save lives.
Right. So you can't, because the animal can't speak, the animal isn't sanctioned enough to actually
take refuge.
Right. They take refuge. So this is, maybe it's the translation that I have here, but that was the impression that I got. Maybe it was done vicariously in the way this was translated. So what can we do? I mean, the book is very detailed, and there's lots of things that people can explore in the book. But if the listener is just hearing you about this book for the first time, I mean, should we become vegetarians? Is that the first step?
Well, basically what I'm trying to lay out through this book is all issues from science, from every possible field, and let people look, this is happening. In France, there was a little cat that was thrown in the air, and everybody, the whole media was about that. People, that guy filmed himself, he was arrested. But the same, of course, it's nice to take cause of little cat or a pig that escaped from the slaughterhouse. It shows that we care. But the same day in France, there were 400,000 animals killed in terrible condition in slaughterhouses. So there is a kind of ignorance of what's taking place. Now, what I'm asking is just see the whole picture, know the situation. You can't say it's behind the walls that you don't see. Okay, it is there every day, all year round. So then take a decision. So how to take a decision? Well, the easiest one, it may be difficult to become an animal rights advocate. And by the way, when people in France, this book stirred more opposition than anything I did before. So when they say, well, what do you do for humans? There's more urgent problem in Syria and everywhere. I say, look, first of all, my organization, Karuna Session, has helped 400,000 human beings last year in India, Nepal, and Tibet. So we certainly did our share. And in fact, to kill 60 billion land animals every year doesn't help Syrians or human rights in China. So stopping to harm doesn't take much time. It doesn't take a lot of CO2 emission. It's just a finger snap decision. So one of the easiest way, of course, is not to make one's stomach a graveyard and not to live at the cost of the suffering and the death of others. That doesn't take much effort except a mental decision to have a coherence in one's ethic of benevolence. So that's not a fanatic sort of dogmatic approach, but at least reduce or try to harm as less as we can. And of course, I have a friend who is always at the edge to say, I know what you say. It's a bit difficult. So I'm trying to tell myself I eat a little, I eat less animals. But would I say, okay, I cannot stop killing, but I can kill a little bit less, So at the end, you find out that yes, if you don't want to harm, and it's simple, you just stop. And when you see the reasons why people continue to eat meat. It's not for health, because now it has been shown again and again that regular meat eating is not very good for health. And the WHO has issued an overall report was based on 600 studies. It's mostly because they like the taste. So the compassion stops at the edge of your plate. So that's quite simple. So I think the life of a horse, of a cow, of a pig is more valuable than, you know, taste. So that's what I think we could, everyone could decide for themselves.
Well, I mean, that I think that's very clear, profound, and a great way to end. Let me just add one thing quickly. I am a vegetarian, so I didn't have that wrestling. But thank after you. Reading the book and focusing on sentience, and this I think is really interesting, and we can I'll just put it out there, but focusing on sentience, I found a new respect for the bugs that are in my house. I just couldn't swat them or kill them. I try to now catch them in a little Kleenex or something and take them outside, because they're sentient, and I don't have to worry about, do they have a soul or no soul, or I'm not eating them. But the mere fact that they have enough sentience to feel pain, I have an obligation to take better care of them.
Great. And if I may say something about one of your colleagues, Rabbi David Rosen, used to be the great rabbi of Ireland. He's vegetarian, and he says the only real kosher meat is to be vegetarian.
Yes, I think that's true. Absolutely true. So great. Thank you very much. We're going to have to end it there.
Oh, it was lovely to be with you again.
Thank you very much. It's always a delight to talk with you.
Okay. Take care.
Au revoir.
Au revoir.
My guest today was Matthieu Ricard, whose newest book, A Plea for the Animals, The Moral, Philosophical, and Evolutionary Imperative to Treat All Beings with Compassion, is excerpted in the November-December issue of Spirituality and Health magazine. You can learn more about Matthieu's work at matthieuricard.org, and certainly you can read the excerpt at spiritualityhealth.com. Support for this show comes from the world-famous annual International Yoga Festival in Rishikesh, India. Deepen your practice, explore your soul, and expand your consciousness in the lap of the Himalayas, the birthplace of yoga, with yogis from around the world. Learn more at internationalyogafestival.org. Essential Conversations with Rabbi Rami is a project of Spirituality and Health magazine. Please log in to spiritualityhealth.com to subscribe to the magazine in print or digital formats, and download the iTunes app for this podcast. Essential Conversations is produced by Ezra Baker, and our program coordinator and executive producer is Alma Tassi. I'm Rabbi Rami. Thanks for listening.